Eric Warburtonry 1, where were you born, please?
Derby.
Which year was this?
In 1939. No, sorry, 1919.
Did you grow up and have your schooling in Derby?
Yes.
Which school did you go to there?
School called Petrie. It was an elementary school.
And how old were you when you finished schooling?
Well, I finished schooling in 1933, and I had to start work. But I continued at Derby Technical College, which eventually became Derby College, which I continued until 1939.
What sphere of work did you go into?
Building. And I was training for taking the examination of Institute of Builders. And that was what I was still doing when I received my instructions to report to the the office of the government, as it were, for joining the army. And in fact, I did quite well in the exam. And they gave me 6 months extension until the exams were completed. And I went then from there straight away into the army.
Had you heard Neville Chamberlain declare war on Germany?
Yes, I had. Received with mixed feelings, obviously. I was quite happy to go as far as that was concerned. Christian beliefs were based in the Salvation Army, and as such I found that there was no problem.
So you didn't have a principled objection to war?
No, I didn't. I felt that there was a job to do, and therefore if I had to contribute, I had to contribute.
Were you in any early bombing of England by the German Air Force?
Yes, but that relates back then to after the time that I trained and after I had joined this unit down in Gillingham in Dorset.
When exactly did you go into the army?
In December 1939.
What was the procedure?
I did a 240-mile journey to my first contact with the army, which was at Aldershot, that is outside Aldershot, a place called Crookham Camp, at Fleet. And we were welcomed with the very acceptable things after such a journey, they said, we have a meal ready for you. In fact, it was a rissole, one rissole on a plate. And that was my first introduction to the army catering.
And then?
We were kitted out the following day, and we had to, some of us were fortunate in that the uniform fitted, but as you know, you went in one door and out through another, which was the QM store, and one soldier handed you one garment, trousers, blouse, went on, until you'd got a whole pile of uniform, and then you went and tried it on, whether it fitted or not. And that was an amusing sight to see these various people in various uniforms, which either were too long or too short or too narrow.
How did you get on with the basic training?
Very well. I found training easy. Marching was no problem to me, and so we had. I enjoyed it. There's lots of people who didn't, but I enjoyed it. I knew that I had a left foot and a right foot, and I submitted to the rigors of the parade ground quite easily, and found that I had no problem with it. I was so hesitated because we had a sergeant who was who had a finger like iron, I think, and he could strip down your coat right from top to bottom without even bothering to undo them. And as long as you could stand there and stand the pulling, and he got you undone without no doing. But the other thing was, of course, that it was bitterly cold, and we were only allowed to wear dungarees. Now, the dungarees were had no pockets, and they consisted of a pair of trousers and a jacket. And these were normally worn over. They were like working overalls, as it were. And so we had to stand there with the wind bristling through from the downs, as it were, or whatever, right across the parade ground, through one pocket and out through the other. Which, I can remember very well, they saw when somebody went down, fell down, or collapsed, as it were, as a result of this extreme cold, there was the sharp instruction to leave him, which one didn't do any other than leave him, and somebody appeared from somewhere and carted him away. Otherwise, it was quite normal.
What other training were you doing apart from drill?
Basic items such as knowing how to avoid certain diseases like VD, crab, and all that sort of thing. We had a particular sergeant who had spent many years in the Middle East, and his name, Virgie Wright, and he was able to impart his information to us by the sort of stretching and closing of his fingers, which was quite remarkable. He didn't do anything other than sort of get along all the time by doing this sort of performance. And that one thing that they did do was to take us out from the parade ground after a rigorous time, and then take us indoors where it was very warm, into the nafe, where they gave us the instructions that they wished to impart. And the contrast of the warmth against the cold, severe cold outside, created one or two problems for people. They fell asleep. And the result of that was that they were waiting and made to stand on tables, I recall, in order to do it. They fell again, they would hurt themselves.
What do you remember happening next?
The major thing that happened after that was that I got, like everybody else did in that period of time, we were only there for a 13-week course, as it were, and on about the 11th week, I had to go sick along with the rest, and with German measles. There was an epidemic, as it were, of German measles, and we were assigned to some married quarters in Aldershot, and somebody had the idea of cleansing these places, I suppose, by washing down the walls on the ground floor. And but because of the severe frost, etc., that has frozen. And it was, in fact, ice up, the, up to about 4 foot high up the walls. But we were upstairs in the bedroom, and there were very tiny little houses, and two to this one bedroom. And there was a camp bed on which we were able to sleep. And if and when they brought a meal in, they would stand at the bottom of the stairs and say, "Come and get it, it's here." And if you didn't appear downstairs pronto with your necessary plate, etc., you got nothing to eat. But that continued for a week. But on the 12th week, I was sent home on sick leave. And that was the end, really, of my training.
Did you feel the training had done you any good?
Oh, yes. I think I enjoyed it. And I thought that the result was remarkable. What they were aiming to do was to produce soldiers, people who were sort of a good example of what the army should be, I suppose. And so, because originally the first 3 weeks were not allowed out, and then the rest of the time we were permitted to go out of the barracks, as it were. And so we had now been properly trained, and we had a soldier's bearing. That seemed to be the main issue on this. So that was, yes, I thought it was very successful. And
what does a soldier's bearing consist of?
Oh, properly dressed and upright, as it were. Changed from what the sergeants and people of that quality used to call cabbages, and into something like a decent citizen, and in fact a decent decent soldierly like manner. And we didn't have we wore the forage caps, so in those days, and so they sat on the side of the head almost. And if your hair had not been left too long, they didn't allow that to happen. The porridge cap sat on quite well. And then, being sick and supposed to be now in a state of recuperation, one had to go home, complete with kit bag and all the rest of the gear, whether you could carry it or not. It was your sort of property, and that was it. So you took it all with you and arrived home and sort of announced that you were home on leave, as it were.
What happened next?
Well, I arrived home. My mother was had been to some sort of meeting together with my father, and where she had learned that the next time I was going to return home, I was going to get married. But she knew nothing of this, and so she didn't speak to me for the first 4 days, because she thought that I was going to do this very thing. But of course, nothing was further than the truth. Somebody had told her some untruth. But I was rather pleased to go back, actually. And after the seventh day, as it were, I returned to Crooken Camp. And there to find that I was now posted. And I was posted to this unit called the 129 Field Ambulance, which was in Gillingham, in Dorset, or Gillingham.
How did you feel about going to such a unit?
I was rather pleased that we were going to be trained something properly, as it were. We now had this training behind us. We And therefore we could now expect to be to know something about the job that we were going to do in the army. My thoughts of long-term thoughts of the army were didn't exist. It was a matter of going to learn what we're going to do, and that was it. I'd never thought about it. A field ambulance, it had never crossed my mind that there were such things. I think the RAMC, as far as I was concerned, was a military hospital. I don't know, I'd never been in one. And so we arrived, as the first intake to this unit, which was a territorial unit out of Plymouth. I have to say that most of the Plymouthians that were there had never been outside Plymouth in their lives before, and I was therefore a well-travelled person and seen a lot more of the country than they had. And we were the only uniformed people available. And we stuck out like sore thumbs, obviously. They were still wearing civilian overcoats. They had a civilian lorry. And in general, it was a little bit like Dad's army, I suppose. And we went to this mob, and I was assigned to HQ. And there were three companies, HQ and A and B companies, and they were very, very well selected, as it were. Most of the Plymouthians were assigned to a B company, as I recall, and the HQ were a select body, as it were. You either were there to do because you knew of a particular job, and I suppose because I was had something to do with the building trade, they thought that they wanted somebody of that ilk in HQ. And so we set out on what I thought was a stepping stone to the real thing, and as it turned out to be, the way of getting to know people was quite remarkable, and we were continued with our training, but in a different way, in that it was. Now you were going to lectures on general on the early stages of training for a medical person. That is the learning of the number of bones, etc., that one has in the body, and the various functions, and all sorts of things that are very elementary. And to do some bandaging in a proper manner, that was the figure of eight, for instance. I remember very well. Figure eight, when there was a bandage required in either of the limbs, and then again, I found that very interesting and quite easy to do as well. Some of the characters are from amongst these chaps from the original my territorial unit were remarkable, and they were a bit sad, really, that they had acquired these people and they had become members of a unit which was now and eventually going to be a part of a war machine. For instance, we had a sergeant who was the provost sergeant. That is what he rejoiced in his title. And of course, one always found the weak point sort of about people, and you would say to him, "What time is it, Sergeant?" And he would proceed to pull out of his field dressing pocket a long piece of string, a very coarse string, and eventually pull it out of about a yard of this string, and eventually it would result in a watch. And he would study it for quite a little while and then say, "Here, you read it." And obviously he couldn't read or write, and he was a sergeant. And those sort of characters, you know, made up the army in the early stages, I'm sure, overall, but it was quite amazing to me that this was what was happening. The same thing with this drill technique. You know, he used to say, "I knows my drills." But on one occasion in particular, we were living in a place called Wyke Hall, and at Gillingham, just outside, and the result of his training was, of his drilling these few people, his squad, was that somebody said to him, "Well, say something to them, Sergeant, if it's only goodbye." The other characteristic, of course, it was the CO, who was a very well-known, a very likeable man, and he was the grandson of Lister, the doctor who, or surgeon, I suppose, who promoted the aesthetic business of the of keeping everything perfectly clean, and because that was essential to all the successful surgery, that is, keeping away the any unfortunate happenings such as disease from opening a wound, and because of it not being aesthetic, it was then being kept clean. And so his grandson, I believe it was, Colonel Lister, was in charge, and he made, of course, his morning. Every morning we had a parade outside of the in the little square of the house, and together with the sergeant major, who was Tomlinson, who was a very nice chap, and so he used to come along and say to anybody that either joined us or one of us, as far as that was concerned, because he felt like making an issue of something or other, and you know, say, "Well, you had to fasten somebody's button up for them, you know." And he said, "Well, shall we put him on parade, Sergeant Major? Shall we put him on jankers, or shall we ask him the important question?" So, of course, Mr. Thomason used to say, "Yes, of course." And so he would say to the poor incident chap, looking at him straight, squarely in the eye, he would say, "Tell me, which is my good eye and which is my bad eye?" And, of course, to the uninitiated, there was a problem. Both eyes looked the same. But in fact, one was a glass eye, which created a lot of hilarity amongst everybody. But it was very good. And he went, therefore, under the name of Popeye. Not in front of his face, of course, but everybody referred to him as Popeye. So the training continued. And I think we got forgotten about, or we felt that we were being forgotten about. Days continued and months continued, and we're still in this area. tied all sorts of things to keep us busy, I suppose. But in the meantime, just the training, the basic training, and went on. In the RMC, there are three grades of qualification, qualified, ranked, as it were, or not a rank in particular. But you had two rings to obtain. One was, if you had no rings at all, you were an ordinary, or an orderly, as it were, and thereby you were qualifying, I think, or unqualified enough to do all the menial tasks, such as sweeping the various rooms out and things like that. If you had made some progress and the opportunity was given to for training medically or first aidish type of thing, was that you gained enough to have one red ring, and then you were an NO2. You became an NO1 without any significance at all, but then an NO2, and this one ring, and that qualified you to be, well, you were considered now to be something of an authority on medical preparation and treatment, as it were, of people. So that's how I gained my first ring there, and proudly wore this red ring on my on the lower part of my sleeve, just above the cuff, actually. And the next, and so it continued, because there were not very many people taking the next grade, as it were. The facilities weren't there. So if you became an NO1, then you were at least a cut above the others, as it were. And this was a sort of separation of jobs, as it were. And I was enjoying this very much, and I thought that, you know, this life was very suited to me. I like the army. So that was it.
Did you stay at Gillingham very long?
Yes, quite a lengthy time, actually. And we stayed there until 1940, late in 1940-41. In fact, we were sent, all of a sudden, the army decided that we ought to be doing something. And so we were moved to Harpenden in Hertfordshire, to Rothamsted Park, and just prior to the evacuation of Dunkirk. And we arrived ostensibly to go to France, of course. And it was when we were at Rothamsted Park they discovered that not only did we have no medical equipment whatsoever, medical gear at all. What's more, we had no vehicles. We had travelled up by train, and so there was no equipment whatsoever. We couldn't move, we couldn't do anything. And so overnight we gained the RASC attached, who were the means of mobile unit, which is now we were discovering that we've got things like ambulances assigned to us. We went, so they went to Hatfield to be kitted out to the lorries or at least they went to get all the medical equipment. And we had a couple of days of concentrated packing and unpacking these lorries, so that one knew exactly where panniers went and where stretchers went and where everything else went. and in addition to the ambulances. And if you were an ambulance orderly, which was if you were an NO1, so nursing orderly class 1, with the red ring, one red ring, then you were liable for duty as an ambulance orderly. That is, you travelled with the ambulance out orderly, and if there were any patients, you were dealing with the patients within the ambulance. And that's all we knew really about the job. And so the rest of, and all of us really were training very, very fast as to